From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An advanced team of UN weapons inspectors landed in Baghdad today with a simple directive and an imposing mission: to disarm Iraq and assure the world that Saddam Hussein does not possess weapons of mass destruction. The Iraqis say they have nothing to hide. Prominent American voices are already calling that a lie. In this hour, former UN weapons inspectors join us to assess the new challenge. Can these inspections work, or is this just theater on the way to war? We begin with the inspections rift already emerging between the United States and the UN. The Bush administration is lobbying for super-aggressive inspection with zero tolerance for Iraqi non-cooperation. Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix is urging a more measured approach. Colm Lynch is UN correspondent for The Washington Post. I asked him about the gap between expectations of the United States and other members of the UN about how the inspectors will do their work.
I think that the United States essentially wants sort of no holds barred inspections. They want these guys to, barge into inspection sites. If there is any delay for minutes or whatever, they're going to want the inspectors and hope that the inspectors come back and sort of report to the council violations. The chief UN weapons inspector, Hans Blix, has made it clear that he's really not going to report on whether Iraq is sort of responsible for violations unless they are guilty of some serious and significant violation. So there's going to be a difference of opinion. I think the Americans are going to be looking at every single infraction as, potential cause for war. And I think that Blix is going to be take a much more nuanced approach to this, unless there are things that the Iraqis are doing, hurdles that they're placing in his way that make his work impossible. I think he's going to want to give them a little bit of flexibility, not a lot, but a little bit of leeway. And I think the Americans, essentially, President Bush has said he wants a sort of zero-tolerance policy.
Will the United States even know about lesser infractions if Mr. Blix is not informing the UN and, by the way, of UN, the U.S.?
They'll know. I mean, some of the stuff will leak out. I mean, if they're sitting at a site for half an hour, it's probably going to be pretty clear within 24 hours, if not within 24 minutes, that they're not able to gain access. If you sort of remember the previous UN Weapons Inspection Agency, sort of information, pretty much filtered out almost immediately after they were confronted with a challenge in their previous inspection. So I think it'll get out pretty quickly.
Your newspaper, The Washington Post, on its editorial page has already come out very strongly saying that Iraq is already lying about the weapons of mass destruction programs that it has underway, almost suggesting that it is already in breach, in effect. Is Washington prepared to run with that? Does that reflect a more general feeling in Washington?
Well, I think the resolution that was passed in the Security Council over a week ago basically fines Iraq in material breach of previous obligations. I think there's widespread acknowledgement that they are in violation of many of their obligations dating back to the end of the Persian Gulf War. The difference is that what is really going to sort of what would have the threat of sort of providing a trigger for military action are sort of continued new fresh breaches. And there's a huge gap between what the United States considers a new fresh material breach and what the rest of the UN community believes. There has been an interesting case on Friday. There was a rather routine exchange between U.S. and British warplanes who patrol two no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq. This one was in southern Iraq with an Iraqi anti-aircraft battery. The anti-aircraft batteries opened fire on the American and British jets. They retaliated, killed potentially seven people, according to the Iraqis. And the Americans are now saying, well, this represents a material breach of the disarmament resolution that was passed over a week ago. Mm-hmm. It constitutes potential grounds for war against Iraq. Now, nobody else besides the United States agrees with this interpretation, and they're not likely to go to the council to make this case because they know they won't be able to sell it in the council. But they're sort of very gradually starting to build up a case, and they're going to start, making a big deal of every small infraction and sort of build up pressure on this over the weeks ahead.
What kind of timetable are people at the UN then looking at these inspections with now, Colin? Is this likely to go on for months and months and months? Or do people expect it to come to some kind of head in nearer term?
There are a couple of key deadlines, and one of the most important ones will be in early December, on December 8th. Iraq is responsible for providing the UN with a full declaration of all of its weapons and weapons activities and many of its civilian activities. So it's going to have to provide the UN with a list of, you know, every brewery they have in the country that has equipment that has dual-use purposes that can be used to make beer or can be used to make biological or chemical weapons. The United States has drafted into their resolution language that would make it clear that any omission, anything that it leaves out about its weapons program in that declaration would constitute a further material breach. That's sort of radioactive language, which means grounds for military action. They're going to have to be very careful how they write that declaration, and that is, everybody's going to look at that as an indication as to whether Iraq is really serious about cooperating with the inspections. And if they don't, the Americans will really focus on that declaration and will try to use that as a sort of a justification for making its case for military action.
And from the United Nations, where you sit, does it look like the Security Council might be prepared, even at that early date, to give the green light to war if that list doesn't look full and frank?
If it doesn't, you know, nothing is ever crystal clear in the United Nations. So people that don't want the U.S. to go to war in Iraq, who think it's sort of against their own sort of strategic interest in the region, Russia, for instance, they're going to probably argue that whatever cooperation Iraq is providing is sufficient. So there will be divisions over that. But despite that, there has been sort of a growing, increasing support for military action if Iraq does not seriously cooperate. So there are a number of sort of lesser countries in the UN community, Australia, even Canada, New Zealand, others who are saying, you know, if the Iraqis don't provide full cooperation, then military force may have to be a last resort.
And even then, even as early as off the December 8th report?
Well, it could be off the December 8th report. It depends how much the Americans want to go to war. If they really push the case, if the violations are serious enough, maybe they can sort of build enough support in the council. I find it hard to believe, but a lot of this will depend on the Iraqis. It really depends if they can convince the broader UN community that they really are seriously cooperating. It's going to be a tough sell for the Americans.
Colin Lynch, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Colin Lynch is UN correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from New York. Do you believe that the UN weapons inspections can work, or is this just a prelude to war? And what would prove to you that Iraq is not a threat now? What would be grounds for a military strike for war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. is David Kaye, Chief Nuclear Weapons Inspector with the United Nations Special Commission on Iraq from 1991 to 1992. He's a senior fellow now at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies, an independent nonprofit research institute. Good evening and welcome, David Kaye.
Happy to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Also with us this hour from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to Mr. Kaye.
David Kaye, you have written in the Washington Post this week that the era of non-coercive, non-proliferation is over. Does that mean that you're giving up on weapons inspections, even on these weapons inspections with their tough resolution from the Security Council and all the new technology that they're taking to Iraq?
No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that the old era, the old type of inspections that we conducted prior to the Gulf War, which really led to the Iraq and I would argue the Iranian and North Korean program, where you really only went where the people being inspected let you go and wanted you to go, that era is past. We're now into an era that, if it's to have any hope, it is to be the coercive type of inspections we now see being carried out in Iraq. That's one reason I think Iraq is so important. If we fail here, I think we're giving up on inspections as a whole.
So with the threat of war sitting just over the horizon and not always over the horizon, as U.S. military planes are over parts of Iraq, do you think that the inspections have a hope? Can they work?
Well, you know, that's almost entirely in the hands of the Iraqis as it has been since 1991. As long as the Iraqis continue to deceive and conceal their program, the best you can hope from inspectors is that they will detect and be able to prove that that deception and concealment is going on. In the face of a state that wants to keep a program, 100 inspectors in a country as large as Iraq have no hope, regardless of the technology they have, of disarming a state.
So how will we know whether or not Iraq is acting on an honest willingness to disarm?
I think the inspectors, if they're intrusive and aggressively led, will be able to tell, and the key is, as your previous guest said, that December 8th declaration. You'll be able to test that declaration and test the Iraqi willingness to let you go anywhere, anytime, with anyone pretty quickly.
You mean because they're expected to give a full inventory of weapons of mass destruction, but they've already said in their letter delivered when they accepted these inspection teams that they don't have any weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the resolution, interestingly enough, does not say a full inventory of your weapons of mass destruction. It says the production process, everything you use to produce a full accounting of the weapons you had at the end of the Gulf War. So they've got to do more than that. In fact, one of the frightening things is actually their declaration, both at the time they accepted the resolution and subsequently when they said, we have no weapons of mass destruction. Come and find what you want.
You're talking about 1991 now.
No, I'm talking about last week.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly what they said when they accepted 1441, the new UN resolution.
Mm-hmm. Remind us of what happened in 91 when this first came about. Iraq was required under the ceasefire, of course, at the end of the Persian Gulf War to submit a complete list of quantities and locations of its prohibited weapons and production systems. What happened in 91?
Well, what they said, for example, in the nuclear area, they said, we have nothing at all. I had to actually remind them that, well, they must have something because there were some things that were prohibited now that were inspected prior to the war, so they amended the declaration just to refer to that. They underestimated by factors of 100 the amount of chemical weapons they had. The inspectors had to discover that. And they said and continued to say until 1995 that they had no biological weapons program at all, a fact that even they admitted in 1995 was a lie. All in all, they submitted 24 full, final, and complete declarations to the previous inspection organization, every one of which proved to be false.
So the first trigger here, or at least the first hurdle, will be when they submit that list. What's it going to be put up against for a kind of test of veracity or thoroughness? Is there an American, a UN list that will be put side by side with Iraq's list?
Well, there's a very good UN analysis. One thing that the last 4 years has been used to is to take all the work that the previous UN organization, UNSCOM, created, everything they discovered, run it through technical review panels to be very clear as to what the gaps were in the Iraqi declarations. So there is really a very good database spreadsheet of exactly what the Iraqis had, where there are gaps in what they reported, evidence of imports that they don't acknowledge. So it's actually, this is going to be a real challenge for the Iraqis. It's very hard to fabricate a good lie on a program as complex as one they had.
Jack Beatty, that would seem to give us hope that this might be completed, that these inspections might actually work if the lists are that good and Iraq knows it.
Yes, and perhaps even if the lists aren't that good. I mean, some people are talking about a kind of robust containment plus, a way of essentially using the intelligence we have, and independent of Iraq's declaration, to essentially tell them, we believe that facility is dirty, and we're going to bomb it. And essentially to use intelligence transparency to expand the no-fly zone so that our inspection, so that spy planes can get in very close there, and any dubious site to strike it. That is much short of war, but it seems to me it could accomplish as much as, and perhaps more than, because it wouldn't have the accompanying costs of war.
We're going to talk tonight in some detail about the possibilities, what inspectors face in Iraq as they're settling in there tonight. UN inspectors arrived today. Hans Blix is there with a couple of dozen in an advance party. More will be following. What do you think? What hope do you place in the UN inspectors? Can inspections work, or is this just a prelude to war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about inspections, weapons inspections in Iraq, about the substance and the theater of inspecting Iraq's weapons cupboards. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you confident that Hans Blix and the UN team will be tough enough, will be thorough enough? Do you fear that we'll get back into endless, ineffective inspections? Or do you fear that inspections won't be given a real chance to work? Join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. We've been talking with David Kay, who's joined us from Leesburg, Virginia tonight. He was chief nuclear weapons inspector with UNSCOM, the earlier U.S. weapons crew from 1991 to 1992. We're joined now from Monterey, California by Raymond Zielinskas. He was biological weapons inspector with UNSCOM in 1994. He now directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Good evening and welcome, Raymond Zielinskas.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Raymond Zielinskas, what's your view of the potential effectiveness of the UN team that is now beginning to assemble in Baghdad? Can they do the job they've been tasked to do?
I think so. I think that, first of all, they have a very good basis in the work that was done by the UNSCOM and the agency in before December 1998. And that work was very complete, except for the biological area, which had a lot of problems as far as the information for the full, final, and complete disclosure. Mm-hmm. So that needs to be cleared up. But the other three disciplines, I think, were fairly well advanced and doesn't need much work on it.
And does it depend on Iraq's full cooperation, or can they get the job done even if Iraq continues its pattern of being resistant?
Well, I just don't think that the Iraqis have much freedom of action as far as resisting. They used to have this denial of deceit program that was run by the Special Republican Guard, mm-hmm. Which was a very sophisticated and I think to some extent effective program to, first deny the existence of the weapons mass destruction programs. And when that was broken down, then to deceive the inspectors as to their extent and intent and so on. But this time they can't do that, because if there's a pattern of interference with UNMOVIC and agency inspection activities, the directors, Blix and Baradei, are enjoined to immediately report that to the Security Council for political action. So I think the Iraqis had to be very, very careful if they want to do some sort of hindrance to the inspectors.
David Kay, what about the trigger for intervention here, or for a report of material breach to the UN and by way of the UN to Washington? Do you think Hans Blix is going to apply the kind of hair trigger that the White House wants?
Well, I hope what he does is he reports any hindrance to the inspection and lets the Security Council decide whether it's a material breach. It's really not up to the inspectors to decide whether it's a material breach. That's a political decision, not a technical inspection decision.
Jack Beatty, I wonder, we've already heard the White House over the weekend today suggesting that Iraqi resistance to American warplanes in the no-fly zones might constitute a kind of material breach. Are you equally confident that Hans Blix and George Bush are going to be on the same page here?
I don't know about the Hans Blix part, but the George Bush part worries me a little bit. A war on Iraq is a weapon of mass destruction. There was just an article in Harper's Magazine, sanctions as a weapon of mass destruction. And I'm very worried at the hawks in this administration, and I'm fearful that they will seize on almost anything to have the war that Mr. Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld seemed prepared to have last August without even a say-so, either of the Congress at one point or of the UN. So I'm worried about the fingers holding that trigger, frankly.
Raymond Zielinskas, you spent time there in Iraq looking for biological weapons. You felt the attitude of the Iraqis. There has been a lot of time and events since then. But can you imagine this crew, this government, just throwing open the doors and saying, all right, here's what we've got?
You know, their back's against the wall. They have really no choice. It's a matter of cooperating, or the Bush administration sending in the Marines with fixed bayonets. They're going to have to cooperate. The only question is whether or not they're going to try to do some more subtle hindrances for whatever reason they might have for that. But they just don't have any choice at this point.
And David Kaye, will we know from the UN weapons inspectors whether they're really cooperating? Let's say even after a list is offered up. You write that the weapons inspectors don't even have helicopters to get them around the country, or haven't had a good air transport. Do they have what they need logistically to do the job?
Well, they clearly don't right now. And I think the idea of 100 inspectors, they're talking now about 100 maybe by the end of the year, less than that until then. For a country the size of Iraq, no helicopters arranged yet. The land transport system is even desperate. The cars that were left there in 98 have not been maintained. It's very difficult to believe in an Iraqi climate that a car that's been sitting around for 4 years is going to be dependable transport. So I think there's some real resource issues for the inspectors that worry me. The practical logistics of carrying out inspections tend to be forgotten in a policy-oriented community like Washington.
And are you confident, as Raymond Zielinskas leans toward being, that Iraq will be less duplicitous this time, that their denial and deceit program won't have the same legs it had before?
No, not at all. I wish I could believe there was that rationality there. I think what Raymond overlooks is this is a country that is led at the very top by a superb master of terror. I don't think any of us can be sure that Saddam believes he has no other way out except complying. I wish, for the sake of Iraq, that is what he believed and that he would do it. I expect that we will have varying degrees of deception and cheating. The only question will be, does it rise to the level that the community of nations is embodied in the UN Security Council? UN Security Council will decide justifies the use of military force. And I suspect there the difficulty of knowing in advance is that test is different for each of the 15 countries on the Council.
Listeners, what hope do you place in the UN inspectors and their work in Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Steve's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
In terms of the deception and duplicity we've been discussing, it occurred to me, and maybe this is dumb, but in terms of what the inspectors might actually find there, is there any possibility that, particularly in terms of biological weapons and the equipment used to make it, that stuff is actually not even to be found in Iraq, that it is perhaps centered somewhere else where it can't be readily found by the inspectors?
Interesting question. Raymond Zielinskas, how about it? It is a highly mobile day and age. I guess first the question is Iraq capable of hiding this stuff so deep inside its borders that it can't be found? Or is it capable of having an offshore germ warfare factory?
Well, now you're dealing with two different issues, but I'll deal with each one. The first is that, of course, Iraq could, if they wanted to, operate a secret program under the noses of the inspectors. But because no inspection system is going to be 100%, just like no verification system for arms control is going to be 100% effective. What a lot of people seem to forget is that you can't have 100% effectiveness in these things. So what you need is an adequate level. And by having an adequate level, what you're doing is making it very expensive and risky for the Iraqi government to operate a secret program. Mm-hmm. Expensive in pure economic terms, because you have to hide everything. You have to bring in utilities into a hidden place. You have to worry about waste products. You have to worry about, in the biological area in a way, about security, biosecurity. And you have to bring in workers secretly into the plant. All that becomes very, very expensive. And then the second risk part is that if this program is discovered either through the intervention of a defector or a whistleblower or by accident, It's a matter of the being reported immediately to the Security Council. It's not a defector saying there's an underground facility somewhere and nobody can prove it, and everybody says, well, maybe yes, maybe no. This becomes a high profile political issue right away that might trigger off armed intervention.
And the offshore fear that our caller raises, is that conceivable, that Iraq could be doing germ warfare production in Germany or Yugoslavia?
It's pretty distant because, for one thing, the Iraqis kept all their weapons of mass destruction program very, very secret, and there was minimal involvement, at least in the biological area, of any outsider. So why they should try to risk it now, it doesn't make any sense. I just don't believe that.
Will's calling from Windsor, Wisconsin. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I think Hans Blix is strong enough to do the job as it should be done. I also have come to the conclusion that no matter what Iraq do, it's Bush's goal to invade that country, not because of imminent danger to this country by Iraq.
Well, let me ask you first about Hans Blix. What gives you the confidence that this well-heeled diplomat is going to go in there and do what's required?
Because I feel that there are some people in this world that are still for peace. And from his record, I don't think this administration has shown where he was weak in doing that. And I think the main problem that America is facing now is that the people are not aware of what's really going on in this country and has been going on for eons. And the media being owned by corporations, what's made public is censored, and we're not getting a true picture of what's happening.
Well, we're trying to dig in tonight. Let me put your observations to David Kaye. Thank you for your call, Will. David Kaye, I guess two things. On the one hand, is Hans Blix, in your estimation, tough enough, is the kind of way it gets framed in the U.S., to do the job? And do you see George W. Bush as capable of resisting military action?
Well, I think Dr. Blix has had a tough lessons in dealing with proliferators. He was head of the International Atomic Energy Agency when the Iraqi program and the North Korean program began, and was surprised by the extent of what they were able to do under previous inspections.
You're putting it in a mild way, but he actually, it turned out that he missed the whole program.
He missed the program.
In the late 80s, I guess.
But he learned, and I think he became a far tougher individual as a result of that. He still is, in many ways, a very soft-spoken academic. I think he's up to the job. I think he understands the job that he has to do. It cannot be very pleasant for him dealing with the Iraqis and their behavior. I don't know if you've noticed today, they arrived in Baghdad. They were met by a very low-level delegation, went to their hotels, and they're sitting around as of tonight still waiting for a phone call for a meeting with any senior Iraqi official.
Raymond Zelinskas, it's a huge weight on Hans Blix's shoulders.
What are you talking about?
Just because he essentially holds the trigger in his hands. If he reports to the Security Council, I'm not getting the cooperation required, well, we know where that goes.
Well, there's two of them, of course. There's him and El Baradei.
Yes.
As David mentioned before, these are technical people, and they are doing a technical job. So it really comes down to them saying, one or both of them saying, we can't do our job, the technical part of the job, and reporting that to the Security Council. So in that way, yes, he does have a trigger.
And David Kaye, what about our caller Will's other point that George Bush It will be hard to restrain George Bush from the military path. Do you agree? You've written that coercive nonproliferation is the wave of the future, that you've got to carry all the way through, and you've even pointed out that without regime change is a big question of what happens after the inspectors leave.
And that's certainly true. Let me tell you, one of the things that people – overlook is weapons programs are based not on equipment that inspectors can eliminate. They're based on the talent of the scientists and engineers and the people who built that. We don't even know what it means to roll back a program if what you mean is just remove the equipment and leave the scientist in place. It could easily be restarted. On the issue of is the president strong enough, I must say my experience has been that presidents, more than most people, realize what a hazardous undertaking war is. They bear the responsibility for explaining to the parents and other loved ones of lives lost, but they also know that adventures, war can turn out in ways you didn't anticipate when you enter it. So I think there is, far from a exuberance to go to war, is generally at the top levels of the government, and I think this is across many administrations, a caution, a desire to find some other way out because war is so unpredictable.
There's a vote for restraint and the reasons George Bush might show restraint. Frank's calling. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Yes. Given that Hans Blix has such limited resources, how can we expect him to do a job that all of Washington police couldn't do, in finding two men in a white van,
which turned out not to be a white van. But if we can't find two guys,
precisely.
Mm-hmm.
My comment off the air. My answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Frank. David Kaye, how about it? You've written that there's still an awful lot of room for improving the capabilities of coercive inspection operations like we're going into now. Can Hans Blix materially do this?
Well, I think one of my great regrets is we didn't use the last 4 years when there were no inspectors in the country to vastly improve the resources that could be made available quickly if the Iraqis were to change their mind and let inspectors come back. I think the caller is exactly right. If you can imagine how long it took, not just to find the snipers, how long it took to prove that powder was anthrax or talcum powder during the anthrax scares, we did not look very well and very capable there. I am worried that he does not have the capability unless the Iraqis choose to fully cooperate. If he's got to do it on his own and discover the weapons that are still being hidden, I think his resource limitations will really hurt.
Raymond Zielinskas, how about it on the chemical and biological front, your specialty? We have this idea that a pot of bad stuff can be buried anywhere in this huge country. How do you track down that kind of quantity?
Well, there's two characteristics about chemical and biological weapons that are pertinent. One is that they're dual-use characteristic. In other words, fermenters and dryers and so on that are very usual in civilian industry can be quickly adapted to produce pathogens and toxins for biological weapons purposes. So that makes it very difficult to differentiate between equipment and facilities that are set up for peaceful purposes and one for military purposes. Okay. So that's one thing. Second, you don't need a big stockpile of biological weapon, especially to mount a big threat. What you need is a seed culture of an agent that you already weaponized, and it's sitting in your freezer or refrigerator and waiting. And once you have that seed culture and you have the equipment, and we know that they have the human resources, you can quickly scale up your production to ton quantities. You can probably do that in a few months.
I have to say, Raymond Zielinskas, that's hardly reassuring, but we'll take your point that you feel hopeful tonight. I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Raymond Zielinskas was a biological weapons inspector in Iraq. In the 90s, he directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute on International Studies. We're talking about inspections in Iraq. Will they work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about inspections in Iraq, talking about the substance and the theater of inspecting Iraq's weapons cupboards. What do you think? What hope do you place in the UN inspectors? Do you fear that we'll get back into endless, ineffective inspections? Or do you fear that inspections won't be given a real chance to work, that we are on our way to war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Our guest tonight is David Kaye. He was chief nuclear weapons inspector in the 1990s with UNSCOM, the predecessor to the team that's going into Iraq today as we speak for the next round of inspections there. He's now a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. David Kaye, we had to let Raymond Zelenskis go before we really got to answer that question, but we let him go feeling still nervous. He's talking about seed cultures of biological and chemical weapons, or biological anyway, that could be picked up anytime by anybody with the talent to do it. How do you solve that problem? How do you really put the cork in the bottle here?
Well, I don't think you put the cork in the bottle by hunting and inspection. It's just too easy. And that's one reason, for example, the Biological Weapons Convention has never had an inspection arm to it. No one's been able to figure out how you have effective inspections. That's why political, in my view, political change is so important. What Iraq needs is a regime that cares about its people, wants to seek prosperity in the region and live with peace in its neighbors, and not to invade and dominate its neighbors, as Saddam has. As long as Saddam is in power, I think we, and more importantly, I think his neighbors, have to worry about his pursuit of weapons like anthrax, smallpox, and other weapons that are really so easy to create these days.
But if that's your position, then you must be praying for a lapse on Baghdad's part that will allow war. Isn't war the only way we're going to get regime change there, or at least the only way to guarantee it?
Well, actually, I would much prefer that the much maligned and dominated Iraqi people, led by their military, would put it into Saddam. And I actually have some hope that if they actually think the alternative is war, which they would clearly suffer, our continuation of Saddam, that may well happen. But there may be no other way than military action.
Jack Beatty, here's the former weapons inspector saying at the very least we've got to keep that gun right at the back of Baghdad's head to keep the pressure on.
Yes, and that's the new factor here. Saddam didn't feel that in 1998. He didn't, and the world didn't want to go to war over Iraq. We had an American administration that didn't want to go to war against Iraq. We clearly have one now that seems to be itching to go. And I think the question David Kaye raised earlier, what is the state of rationality between the ears of Saddam Hussein? Is he getting this message? And, you know, all of this isn't necessarily stick. There's some carrot here. I mean, the British ambassador in his speech at the Security Council when they were passing this resolution said, he himself said, you know, we can look at rolling back sanctions for a disarmed Iraq. Well, political leaders do things when they can get some benefit. And there does seem to be, at least on the part of the British, who are our allies here, a willingness to say, you get rid of your weapons, you make a clean breast of it, and by God, we can do something about those sanctions. So he could get something out of this.
But it's a hellishly difficult line to walk here. David Kaye is saying we have to essentially have the war threat be fully active and real. You're expressing concern about a White House itching to go to war. If they don't appear to be itching to go to war, then the threat's not real.
Well, that's true, but, you know, between using a threat effectively and getting the benefit of it and actually carrying through, I think that, The that's a step that is so prolific with unknowns and suffering and danger and death. That's the route I don't think we should go down.
There's the razor's edge. Siddiqui's calling from Roxbury. Hi, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, essentially, look, the Bush administration, they desperately want this war with Iraq. And I believe that at this point that Saddam has outfoxed them. And the impression I get with Hans Blix is that, you know, he's a very free-spirited, independent-minded individual who's going to do this at his own pace, which has a dramatic effect on the strategic aspects of the military going into Iraq. So, you know, I truly believe that George W. Bush and his people are very impatient, and I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, we had a Johnson-type Tonkin Bay situation. For the last 11 years, we've had the no-fly zone, and no U.S. planes have come down. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if suddenly a U.S. plane was brought down by Iraqi.
So you expect to see something falling from the sky along the Gulf of Tonkin lines?
There's going to be a war one way or the other. And what right now, the Bush administration, they're stymied because of the fact that these weapons inspectors are in there, and they're going to be moving at their own pace, and it's going to take them a while to do their job. And so they're going to find a reason to make a war in there. Bush.
We've got it. Let me put it to our guest, Siddiqui, and thank you for your call. David Kay, how about it? On the issue of pace, can Hans Blix work at the pace that he desires? And does Washington have the capacity to create an incident given the UN process, which is now in place?
Well, you remember the pace that he has to work at is really not Dr. Blix's choice or really even the U.S. government's choice. That pace is laid out in a Security Council Resolution 1441, which says 60 days after the inspectors begin inspection, and no later than 21st of February, they must report back to the Security Council on the state of their what they found during the course of inspections.
But what if the only thing that's missing is their ability to cover the turf? What if Iraq is complying, but there's still just a lot of acres to inspect?
I think they will report that back and ask for more time.
So that seems to make that deadline rather malleable.
Well, I think it is malleable if, in fact, they're cooperating. I think if you reach the 21st of February, actually, they're planning to begin inspections on the 27th of November, so it will be a little bit before the 21st of February. If, in fact, they've met a lack of cooperation and report that back, I think there is, I would say, almost agreement in the Security Council already that they don't want to get trapped in the old games of UNSCOM, of cheat and retreat, denial and deception, that they will say, well, you may not have found everything or you may not have found anything, but what you have found is that Iraq has not complied in the sense of freely making available all of its weapons and listing them, and therefore we've got to consider another step.
But is it physically possible for Iraq to open all of its doors and the inspectors to confirm that they're all clean on that timetable?
It's physically possible for them to open all of their doors. The actual process of doing it, as long as the inspectors report back after 60 days, there's full and open cooperation. We're meeting no problems. But, you know, the program was so large that with the number of inspectors we have, it's going to take longer. I think in that case, the Security Council will readily give them additional time.
And in the scenario that our caller describes, where the U.S. is not satisfied with that because it wants military action, we're just imagining this. Can you imagine Washington being able to create an incident to go in ignoring the rest of the Security Council or just pulling them along in their wake?
I just cannot. I'm not a fan of conspiracy theories, and the belief that a president of the United States or a secretary of defense would arrange to allow an American man or woman flying in their country's service to be shot down just to precipitate a war is beyond what I can imagine. I will say, I, along with a number of others, are amazed that during the last 11 years, the Iraqis haven't at least hit one aircraft. And that is always a danger. I tried to explain that to the Iraqis. The danger of the situation they're in is they could, by their own actions, ignite a war, quite independent of what they may think they're doing. I think there is a danger of a shootdown in the no-fly zone. I do not believe in a conspiracy that will do it so that we'll have an excuse to go to war.
David Kay, you leave us on the edge of our seat. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
Happy to be with you. Bye.
David Kay is senior fellow at the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. He was chief nuclear weapons inspector with UNSCOM in 1991-92. Jack Beatty, this is going to be a wild couple of months to watch.
It is, and we remember that in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a shootdown of a U-2 plane at the very worst time of the crisis.
It can happen. It has happened.
It has, indeed.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a mother reflects on war as her son leaves for basic training. This is One Point. Sue Diaz never thought news reports of American military missions overseas would ever hit close to home, but that was before her 18-year-old son, Roman, decided to enlist in the United States Army. Now she's wrestling with the reality that her son could be soon on the front lines of the war on terror, perhaps a war on Iraq. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz shares her thoughts as her son heads off to basic training.
No, not like that, Mom. Like this. I'm standing in the family room, and my 6-foot-1 son is teaching me how to salute. I note how the tips of Roman's fingers lightly touch near his eyebrow, how his hand, wrist, and forearm form a nice straight line that angles in sharply at his elbow. With his arm lifted like that, I can't help but also notice how the waistband of his boxers billows above the belt loops of his hip-hugging jeans. I try again. "Better," he says, nodding. A booklet he brought home a few days ago, Compliments of the Local Army Recruiter, lies open on the coffee table. In it are things every new recruit needs to know, including whom to salute and how. My son is a new recruit. He has much to learn, and, I'm afraid, so do I. We're not a military family, though my father was proud to have served in the infantry in World War II. We're no more patriotic than most, not particularly political either. So how did our son come to enlist? A combination of things. Both he and his older sister, now a senior at Stanford, were raised with the phrase, "When you go to college." But last year, Roman, 18 and headstrong, decided he didn't want college, at least not right after high school. He'd work instead at the firm where he was a part-time web designer. When that company folded after he graduated, Roman decided to move to a city 100 miles away with a buddy. Life would be his classroom, but he found that particular course harder than he ever expected. After 9/11, jobs were scarce for self-taught webmasters in baggy jeans. So he made ends meet, barely, with odd jobs. "Have you thought any more about college? Your dad and I would help with that, you know," I said on more than one occasion when he came home for a weekend visit. But he was determined to make it on his own. And so, in his quest for independence, my maverick son has joined forces with Uncle Sam. His lease up, his enlistment papers signed, Roman's back at home before heading to basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia. Every morning over coffee, I unfold the newspaper and debate whether to read the Iraq stories. Before now, I'd read news of conflicts in the Middle East and other parts of the world, but that was when the term troops was just another word in the headlines. Now, that word has a face, and that face belongs to someone I met for the first time 18 years ago in a hospital delivery room. That day, I looked into my newborn son's eyes and thought about all that life might hold for him. Foxholes on the outskirts of Baghdad were not on that list. It's the day before he's scheduled to leave. Taking a break from packing up stuff in his room, Roman shuffles over, plops down beside me on the couch. Without preamble, he lays his head on my shoulder. He hasn't willingly done this since maybe the third grade. I slip an arm around him, press my lips against his bristly hair. Today our family's private D-Day has arrived. Roman strides down the hall, his backpack slung over one shoulder. He puts it down to say goodbye. At the front door, he and his dad hug in that self-conscious way men who know each other well hug. Then it's my turn. I wrap my arms around his waist, my tears mottling the T-shirt he just ironed. "Love you," I blubber. "Me too, Mom," he whispers. He turns, picks up his backpack. My husband and I follow him and his sister, who's driving him to the pickup point, out to the car at the curb. Roman slides in on the passenger side. Just before he closes the door, he looks over at his dad and me, standing together in the yard where he used to play hide-and-seek, and my eyes meet his. Suddenly, I lift my hand, wrist, and forearm in a nice straight line, making sure the tips of the fingers of my right hand lightly touch near my eyebrow. With a crooked smile, Roman returns this salute. Then, facing straight ahead, my soon-to-be-a-soldier son looks toward a future that none of us in this new world can be sure of anymore.
Sue Diaz is a writer living in San Diego, California. Her son, Roman, is at basic training in Fort Benning, Georgia. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that could make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBU.